Hello and welcome to the Super Secret Tech Podcast. This is episode number 5. We're a weekly podcast devoted to Magic the Gathering news, opinions, and insights with an eternal state of mind. I am your host, Brooks, joined by my co-hosts, Adam, Topher, and Peter. In today's show, we're going to be discussing early plays in Legacy. This includes how to identify decks, read their hand, and how to not get blown out by their potential disruption. Also, at the end of the episode, we will be asking you a trivia question. Any correct answers will be entered into a drawing for a hot slice of lovin' from Peter. But before we get into all that, let's talk about our weeks in Magic. So I know you guys went to an event over the weekend, a Legacy event. Is that correct? I hear there are some interesting stories that we're going to find out about later, but definitely some interesting stories.
Oh, yeah. We all went down to Scholars Games. They had a re-grand opening tournament, about 50, exactly 50 people
came down for some Legacy.
50 people came down for some Legacy. It was all right. I played Alurin, Bug Alurin, for the first time ever, which probably wasn't a great idea looking back. I went 3-3, had a lot of fun. I hadn't played Alurin since it was the four-color Imperial Recruiter version. So I wasn't really familiar with the list. I got some losses due to not playing entirely correct. Although it's been about 3 years or so since I've managed to beat Oops All Spells. And I beat Oops All Spells due to actually running Force of Wills for once. So that was nice.
Did you have any like regrets for your last X years not playing with Force of Will in that moment where you're like, yeah, gotcha?
Kind of.
It's more like all this time I wasted.
No, because I love me some elves. So it was a good change of pace. I did it really so I could make myself a better elves player against bug strategies, just because I'm not super used to playing anything that's not elves or anything that's not like pure combo like Storm.
Plus, I'm sure, Lauren, it gave you a nice easy transition too, since the deck plays between 4 and 6 elves in the main deck. So yeah. It felt a little bit like home.
Yeah, I ran 6 elves. I did destroy someone else who was playing elves and like mocked his list horribly after because it was subpar.
You mocked it to his face?
Well, yeah. He needs to learn how to get better.
Get good.
He's not lying. He's not lying. I walked over to the table and the dude had his deck pulled apart.
I'm just imagining the guy like holding his deck in his hands like someone who's just like lost their baby.
He rarely played elves or was fairly new to the deck. So he had never sideboarded out Natural Order, for example. I referred to the Nissas in the sideboard that he was running as something I really want to be sideboarding in when Natural Orders come out. And he looked at me like I had two heads.
Wait, you don't have two heads?
Sorry, he looked at me like I had two heads. However, one of us did not completely scrub out of the tournament. Topher, how'd you do?
Generally, when I'm in contention for top 8, I don't lose my win-ins. It's just like, not. I mean, unlike Adam, just like luck seems to favor me, I guess, in that regard. If I'm in contention in the last round, I generally win. Not this time. I was 4-1 going to the last round and had a really tough loss against Legends of Miracles. It's not a good matchup for me. Not like horrific or anything, but Legends of Miracles generally beats the other builds of Miracles. But since I was running Mentors in the side, the post-board games were a lot closer. So I lost game 1, got game 2. Game 3, I don't think I'll ever have another game like this. I basically had complete control of the game from beginning to end. Unfortunately, due to a combination of just, you know, I don't want to call it luck, but lucky moments on his part, plus genuine misplays on my part. Like, basically, the defining play of the game was me accidentally putting a mentor in my graveyard when it got Terminus, which mattered because my second mentor got Supreme Verdicted, and I ended up not being able to kill him before I decked myself. I had, like I said, I had complete control of the game, but didn't matter. So I lost my game 3, winning in. due to decking myself and did not top eight. So I sucked.
Oof, all that card advantage led to the loss.
I know. All I could think about was like all the extra predicts. Like I think I predicted like 5 times game three. And all I could think about was like the last 2 predicts were just gravy. Like I didn't need to predict, but it's like, well, I'm casting Snapcaster. I might as well predict. It's like,
ugh. So that's what you get for failing to maintain game state, Tofei.
Yeah, I know. I can't. Because I'm like staring at the first mentor in my graveyard. And I'm like trying to figure out, okay, what are my win cons left after he Supreme Verdicted me? And it's like, all right, I've got 1 Snapcaster left in my deck. That is my last win con. And I'm like, wait, how did the first mentor get to the graveyard? Because he had, like, how did it happen? I never even cast it. So I don't know. Like, I guess I did cast it. Well, that's what confusion is, because I ended up casting mentor like 4 times that game, but there were like multiple terminuses. So I honestly, like, I don't know which mentor was which, but I know that the only time a mentor was put to the graveyard was at Supreme Verdict. Never got countered, no engineer explosives, uses EE on a counterbalance. He didn't have multiple Supreme Verdicts. There was no chumping it. So I don't know what the hell happened.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
Yeah, I was pissed off because at the end of the game, after I lost, I'm like asking him, like, hey, can I see your graveyard? Because I want to see, okay, what the hell is in here that killed my mentor? And there was nothing. It was just terminuses.
Now, if you thought my 3-3 finish was bad, hey, Peter, how'd you do?
Peter, were you in the giant spider bracket?
I was playing some real either A matchups or some wildly unexpected decks.
Why not?
I was playing old reliable. I was playing red green lands.
Okay.
I was testing a couple new things out on the board. And went there with some high hopes and got trashed my first few rounds. And round one was against Show and Tell. And while it's a bad matchup, I took it to game three. And both games 2 and 3, after I had won game one, I had the combo out when he decided to play Show and Tell and just put in a play Omniscience.
Yeah, that'll do it.
That'll kill you.
No, the tilting part here was that the guy was like, whew, man, that was so close. Whew, boy, and just kept like playing it up. And it's like, dude, you had an Omniscience in play. What were you worried about?
You realize we call this edging. It's a technical term where you slowly build up for your own gratification.
I could not get off of that out of that table quicker.
You couldn't get off of that table quicker. Well, that's the point, Peter.
My second match was against Adam, and again went to a game three. It was fairly close, I felt, and then the penultimate turn, Adam had Alurin and the combo after I had already K-gripped the first 2 Alurins.
I mean, that's why they play 4, right?
You're right. You're not wrong. So my third match was against a deck I have never heard of. And when he went Snow-Covered Plains Pass, I knew I was in for some trouble.
Snowed in a little bit, huh?
Oh, I sure did. Round 4, I was paired up against this kid that he had points at this point, and I didn't. So I just conceded to him and just played some games. Following round, I got the bye. And the final round, I sat down to Adam's Oops All Spells opponent and didn't even bother pulling out my deck. I signed the match slip in his favor and said, I'm good.
Did you microwave a Lean Cuisine somewhere and just sob into it like after the round? Because that's what I'm imagining happening.
First of all, Peter managed to go 0-6. Even the bye beat him.
Right.
How about you, Brooks? How was your weekend magic?
My weekend magic was interesting to say the least. As promised from last week, I ran the red black Goblin Welder Reanim Hitter deck through a league, and I've never felt so exhilarated and saddened that I lit $12 on fire ever before. Low points were losing 4 out of 5 of the matches in the league. High points winning one match in the league against somebody playing Sneak and Show by setting up Goblin Welder, Hope of Ghirapur, and Mere Battlesphere. They did not play any more things for the rest of that game.
Brooks,
and that happened two in a row.
I do have a question for you.
Shoot.
Did your opponent message you anything in the chat? Like, what the hell am I losing to here?
He did. He first said, this is an interesting take on Red Black. I just sold it off to get Sneak and Show. And then, after the Hope of Ghirapur attacked him, he said, what the hell is that? And then after I sacrificed it, and it passed to him, did he fully, truly understand what was happening as I entombed on his end step for the Mere Battlesphere after staring at his hand of spells he couldn't play and welded, you know what I mean? Basically, on his turn, just staring at his hand.
Isn't that worth the $12, Brooks?
I don't know. My Magic player EV senses are tingling and saying, no, you moron, that wasn't worth the $12, plus the money you lost on picking up those cards and reselling them to a vendor. But
you sold it already?
Yeah, I did. It was miserable. It was super miserable, but it was fun. Maybe just for a second, it was fun. And that's really what that $12 is. It's the cost of entertainment. Outside of that, I played in the Community Legacy League yesterday, and I ended up taking first place in that. So that was a pretty good week as far as I'm concerned, and made up for the misgivings of Red Black Goblin Welder Reanimator. Been trying out some new changes in lands. I've gone down to 2 Mazeviths, and I don't miss the third one. It just seems kind of unnecessary with all these untargetable creatures running around.
That definitely makes some sense.
Yeah, it's just so bad in a lot of matchups that I end up taking that anyways, so just why not just play 2?
Yeah, real question is, did you replace it with a sweet, sweet Caracas yet?
Not in the main deck, no. I have self-respect. I mean, reasons. Let's get into the most recent and pressing piece of Magic news. Modern Masters has had some incredible spoilers that continue to ooze value. How much do you think these reprints will apply downward pressure to prices of cards in both Modern and Legacy? Particularly, some of the cards I'm talking about are Cavern of Souls, Tarmogoyf, Lily of the Veil, Snapcaster Mage, and Blood Moon. It really feels like the gang's all here. Do you guys feel like there's anything they missed? Is this going to actually fix pricing? Did WotC finally get it right with a reprint set?
On my end, it looks very sweet. There are certainly a lot of high-value cards that were printed that will help people get a good deal on some very powerful cards that they can, you know, build their modern decks around. Things like Liliana, Blood Moon, they're just pillars of the format, Snapcaster. On the other hand, all the mythics have been spoiled so far, and there is not a single Legacy card that I play that I do not already have the original foil for that has been spoiled. So,
well, not everybody has the largesse that you do, Adam. Do you think that this is going to help with pricing for people just getting into the format?
Yes, it'll be good for players.
See, what I'm worried about is that we're going to have the colorless Eldrazi situation happen again. So Eldrazi stuff gets printed in Oath of the Gatewatch. People figure it out, the deck is kind of busto. So what happens as a response to that? Because all the cards are so cheap, you know, all the Eldrazi cards. Well, the Eldrazis don't go up, but the other pieces in the deck do spike in price, looking at you, Ancient Tomb and City of Traders, to kind of more formally match a traditional Legacy deck's pricing value. Do you think that's going to happen, or are these cards so bread and butter that they may go down in value, but the duels will hold?
Would not be surprised to see things like Raging Ravine go from $10 to $20. The support cards will probably go up. Mishra's Bauble, as of yet, at least,
it's almost
unspoiled.
At 40.
Yes, for a modern legal uncommon.
Holy crap!
If we thought
a bad card,
I just sold a foil Japanese one for like $90. Now I feel like I got ripped off.
Yeah, you did. You probably get like $700 for it. All right, exaggerating a little bit, but.
Well, I'm hoping that it's included in the commons and uncommons. It would be a really great addition, and they're definitely cognizant of it by having Death Shadow be in the set. They're cognizant of the value of that card. So, fingers crossed, no promises, though.
It does look like a very exciting, fun, limited format so far. I'm a big fan of the cube-style drafts, I guess, where mana fixing is very heavy. You can play the, you know, the sweet cards.
You get pushed out to more weird and wild and wacky strategies, but it's okay because you can fix for it.
Yes, exactly. You open that Bomb Liliana. Well, fuck it. Play blue, white, flash, blink, splash, black for Liliana. Whatever. You only live once.
I think the kids call that YOLO these days, Adam.
Adam isn't a child. He's only playing a child's game.
Hey, 13 and up, teenagers.
Yeah, for real, bro. Get your shit together, Peter.
Excuse the hell out of me.
Yeah. Topher, are you excited about this draft format? I mean, anywhere you can pair up Path to Exile, Snapcaster Mage, and Restoration Angel potentially in limited seems like something you could probably get turgid about.
Turgid. I mean, as a draft format, sure, though I am confused. I thought they said it was not being built for draft, and now it is. But, yeah, I'm excited to draft it. Like Adam was saying, mana fixing always makes for a fun, limited format. As for card reprints, I mean, I'm certainly happy that the cards got reprinted just because it's generally better than not that they do. But I'm not so certain that the prices are going to see a dramatic shift. Demand always finds a way of keeping up.
Luckily, we have some precedent for the Modern Masters and Eternal Masters sets about how the values seem to work out. It seems that the Mythics will drop by a small percentage. They'll bottom out a couple weeks after the set's released, and then they'll go up to back to their previous value, maybe sans $5 or $10. Rares, on the other hand, seem to drop a decent chunk of value and will hold it, unless it's like a big staple. But even then, the big staples are hurt. See Wasteland from Eternal Masters. And the commons and uncommons generally plummet as well. And they'll hold that value. But I would definitely be happy to see a lot of the values on some of these cards come down, especially at common and uncommon. The more they make dents in it, the more accessible Eternal Magic is to players.
For each new modern player that is one modern player that can soon be disenfranchised and convinced to play Legacy.
We'll be right back with our main segment. Stay tuned. Welcome back. In this week's main segment, we will be discussing the importance of early deck identification and how to leverage that knowledge to increase your chances of winning. While some early game plays in Legacy can be pretty unclear, say a Volcanic Island into a Ponder, some are pretty gut and dry, Forest into Wirewood Symbiote, looking at you, Adam. As a quick note, we will be sticking to mostly top-tier decks without delving too deep, lest we lose ourselves in the incredibly deep pool that is Legacy. I know that Topher is a fearless Miracles player, so I will ask a cowardly lands player instead. Peter, what turn one plays are you most afraid of when you're playing lands?
I gotta say, my two biggest opening plays I hate to see, Soul Land, either Simeon Spirit Guide, Lotus Petal, Blood Moon, or Show and Tell. Those two terrify me. Or turn one, basic Swamp Duress. Also
basic
pretty scary.
Swamp Duress. You see, I would go down a similar route where my most terrifying turn one play for my opponent is basic Swamp Dark Ritual.
Oh, Dark Ritual implies they're going off. The rest is just they're setting up. They're checking your hand out.
They're like, hey, what's going on over here? Do you just auto-concede to the turn one Swamp Duress, Peter? Like, is that a thing you've done in the past? Because it sounds like that's something you might want to do.
I've thought about it, and I know I have done it in the past, like, If I'm on the play sometimes to like conceal what I'm on, if I don't have any response and I know they're on Storm, all I'll have is a Misty out. I'll just concede, won't give them the information.
No, that totally makes sense. How about you, Adam? Like when you're playing against any deck with, you know, elves or whatever your flavor of the week is, what do you hate to play against? What are you most scared of out of your opponents?
Oh, hold on. Let me take a guess. I'm pretty sure your least favorite thing is Chromox exiling Daru Warchief. Chromox New Liliana.
Or Thalia.
Thalia,
would also be pretty bad.
Yeah, that'd be...
New Liliana would be pretty bad, but...
Yeah. plus one. Okay.
No, not two Chromox exiling two white cards into Liliana, Peter. I would say, from the point of view of elves, the single play I least like to see would be turn one Sol Land into Chalice, just because not only does it mean I'm going to have to jump through hoops if I ever want to play anything and advance my game plan, it also means the game will, I probably won't get to do much for a while, but I won't die. It's not like, you know, turn one, you know, show and tell, turn one, dark ritual ad nauseum. When my opponent goes turn one, Chalice, I know I'm just going to sit there and die for like four turns.
Nah, bro, you just got to be good enough to have that Cavern of Souls in your opening hand. Just turn one, Cavern of Souls, elves. What?
That is
every
true.
Time
I'm not...
I've chaliced you on one, you always have the cavern.
That's true. However, elves has to run things like main deck Cavern of Souls. It just shows how bad Chalice actually is.
I'm just picturing Adam playing the Cavern of Souls on elves after the opponent has played their Chalice on one. Just slam it down, say elves, stand up, and just give him the middle finger across the table. Just,
just
right
pull down
there.
My drawers, piss all over his deck. Yeah,
yeah, can, yeah. That's why they double sleeve it. It's moisture protected.
Can yeah. confirm.
can confirm. My deck has been urinated on.
Yeah, but no, because the elves really doesn't want to be playing a turn one Cavern of Souls. You want forests for your Quirion and Ranger shenanigans. So it's a feel bad play. Even when you do have it, you're like, wow, I wish this was a fetch one drop and you weren't giving me the business.
How about you, Topher? I know as a Miracles player, you actually get to play a Force of Will, unlike some of us other filthy scrubs on this podcast. So you are probably a little bit less afraid of anything in particular, but is there anything that you really just don't want to see across the table from you?
Seabrooks, you're assuming something here. Topher fears no one.
Well, I'd say my reaction is kind of like tied up in knowing my matchup against said deck. Like, obviously, turn one Tomb Chalice is pretty backbreaking. But I'd say I'm more likely to fear, like, is more in line with what I expect. Like, it's not how to respond to the opener play. It's what the opening play implies. So, like, turn one, you know, Underground Sea Deathrite Shaman can be a slog, or can be opener Deathrite Shaman can often mean what is necessary for certain decks to get ahead of me, you know. So I'm never excited to see a turn one Deathrite Shaman. But as for, like, just what plays I see, and it's like, you know, Christ, I'm playing against this deck. I mean, I guess Cavern of Souls Eldrazi is probably the number one.
That's pretty scary. Yeah. I can imagine Cavern of Souls on Wizard, Sensei's Divining Top on turn one out of your opponent is probably pretty terrifying, too.
I played a fucking Miracles opponent who kept a Cavern of Souls like as their only land. But you can do what you want.
He knew he was...
I'm not going to be too worried.
When I think of the Miracles perspective, although I'm not a Miracles player, the kind of openers I would think you don't want to see your turn one Underground Sea suspend an Ancestral, or...
Yeah, I mean, that can be tough. I mean, keep in mind, there's no play that I can't navigate towards an answer for. So I don't necessarily fear turn one Vial or turn one Ancestral, though those cards are certainly powerful cards that will be, you know, challenging for me to beat. It's more of what do these plays imply about the deck I'm playing against.
it's not that I fear the Vile, it's that I fear that, all right, this guy's going to have to beat a Mother who is protecting a Sanctum Prelate. It's not because I fear the Ancestral Visions, it's because, all right, I'm going to have to out-muscle Jason Liliana this game or something.
And that's really the most interesting part of the entire format of Legacy, and really the meat and potatoes of our discussion here today, is that there are so many different decks in Legacy, and they do share a lot of cards. And the more that you know about the format, the more able you will be to identify a deck in the first two turns of the game and then craft your game plan. This ties into last week where you need to know your role, whether you're the aggro beatdown plan or whether you're the control plan. And the earlier you figure that out, the more you can maximize your chances of winning the game. But beyond that, there's a lot of information that you can glean just based off of your opponent's plays in the first couple turns about what's in their hand, what they're playing, and how you're supposed to counter it. Miracles is a great example because Miracles has the ability to shift gears when it needs to, or just plain out control and answer whatever your opponent's playing. And I think that's what's so important about identifying a deck, especially someone as experienced as Topher, knowing exactly what outs they're playing to from turn one and a half. What are some unique and or easy to spot openers, you know, just getting into Legacy, that people are very likely to see and very likely to help identify a deck very quickly?
A lot of plays are going to, your opponent goes turn one, Mount Swift Spear or Mount Goblin God, I guess. The mystery's already over, you know? You don't really need a lesson to know that that's burn. But, some of the other plays that might be telling but not immediately obvious would be like this person fetch a basic land, let's say your opponent goes basic forest death, right? You gotta know, all right, this could be elves, this could be shardless, frankly this could be any non-delver bug deck, but it's telling if they fetch that forest. If so, what fetch land did they use?
Just to compound on that, not only is it what fetch land did they use, but also the fact that there is no blue duel coming out here, like you said, it effectively puts them off of Delver and Daze via proxy, because they would want that if they had it.
Interesting you say that. Like I mentioned earlier in the episode, I was playing Allurn this weekend, and I played against someone who I'd previously played against on Elves, and I led off game one with a Misty into a Bayou into a Deathrite, and he...
You sneaky, sneaky snook.
And I mean, to be fair, that's my only real turn one play. So I get it, but he didn't know that. So it's in Legacy, especially since the mana base, you can fetch any color with any fetch, can make it difficult to identify, especially when they're starting out with something like Deathrite Shaman, which can be any one of 30 different decks.
Yeah, that one mana Planeswalker is really strong last time I checked. So I know you guys mentioned a bunch in the things that you were afraid of playing against when opponents will start out with something like Ancient Tomb into Chalice of the Void. Fast mana is always a really scary situation in Legacy, especially decks that are able to back it up with some sort of clock, particularly Eldrazi Stompy here. It's pretty easy to identify Eldrazi Stompy in the first two turns of the game. They'll either lead with an Ancient Tomb or something like Eldrazi Temple, Eye of Ugin. The jig is up. That's an easy one. But there's a lot more context to some of these other decks out there. Topher mentioned Forest into Deathrite Shaman. That basic forest is what I'm going to call a signpost card. Now, what a signpost card is that when you see it come out, it tells you contextual information about the deck they're playing. So in this example, the opponent going fetch forest into Deathrite Shaman can tell you a couple things. It tells you they are not on Daze. It also tells you, because they're not on Daze, they are not playing a Delver deck. So this narrows the deck choices that your opponent could be playing down to only a couple options. Still various, but definitely only a couple. So now we'd be looking at Bug Allurin, Elves, True Name Bug, or Shardless Bug. And those decks generally have a controlling bent to it, which if your deck is able to play the beatdown here, it seems like a good opportunity for you to seize the initiative, if you will.
I feel it needs to be said here is that the advantage of identifying a deck, like, really is only significant in, I'd say, the first turn of the game, maybe the second turn, because obviously as the game goes, you know, you're going to know what your opponent's playing. When you don't know what your opponent, quite know what your opponent is playing, you still need to have a good idea of what you're trying to do and what you need to play around. So even if you don't know 100% what your opponent is playing, there are enough similarities between these decks that share an opener that you have a good idea of what is worthwhile playing around. You know that if it's one of these three different decks, I still want to be the beatdown against all of them, so I should be making aggressive plays here. You know, if your opponent goes very, very generic, turn one, Underground Sea Ponder, you know, that could be Storm, that could be Delver. So if you're playing a deck like Shardless, you know you're going to be the control deck in both those matchups. So you know that, you know, do you want to spend your first turn, let's say you're playing Thoughtseize in your main board, some lists do. Do you go to turn one Thoughtseize, or do you go turn one Deathrite Shaman? You know, that's a play worth considering if you can figure out what your opponent is playing. If you take away anything from what we say, it should be the significance of making your decision in the first, maybe second turn. You know, you don't have to be 100% certain, but you need to be confident enough to say, all right, I need to be beat down here. I need to be control here.
What I'm playing against the generic opener is like Volcanic Island into Ponder, say, which could be anything from Miracles to Show and Tell to Storm on Elves. I have to play as if it's Show and Tell, because if it does happen to be Show and Tell, I'm going to be dead by turn three. So I have to, if I have an aggressive hand, I have to dump it out. If it ends up being Miracles on turn two, I can hopefully recover from being so overextended, but I have to play as if maybe next turn I die to an Emrakul or I die to a Tendrils for 20. So that makes it difficult for me when, you know, when I do play a Miracles player who goes, you know, Volcanic Island Ponder, I'm gonna overextend.
Sometimes those lines of play work out too, you know. They don't always have the Terminus. They don't always have the Swords to Plowshares. And, you know, you can still get them, but the odds are definitely not in your favor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's exactly why it's so important to figure out what you're playing against as soon as possible. I know when I'm playing lands, I need to know whether I'm going to be able to use my Ghost Quarters to pinch their mana effectively, or whether I'm going to have to play a slower game, or whether I'm going to have to go for that Merit Lodge as soon as possible. For example, as a lands player in the True Name bug matchup, which is usually pretty fast to identify because they'll lead on a Deathrite or a Noble Hierarch on turn one, I know that I cannot meaningfully interact with True Name Nemesis and Leovold. Not only that, it is very difficult for me to pinch their mana because they play exactly three basics. So Ghost Quarter is not very effective by the time I'm able to really get it churning. So I know that my route to victory at that point is predicated entirely on my ability to make a fast 20-20 and dome them to death in the sky with it. So the sooner I figure out that that is what I need to do, the sooner I can act on that game plan.
So I'm going to give a specific example. Early today, I was playing online, and I went turn one, basic island top. I was on the play. And my hand had just normal mixture of reactive cards. I think I may have had one other land. What was important is I had both counterbalance and counterspell in hand, along with Swords to Plowshares, which ended up being relevant. My opponent goes turn one, played a Tropical Island, and cast Noble Hierarch. So that's either Infect or True Name Bug. And here's what it means for me going into my second turn. I can not spin my top, play my land, which was an Erin Mesa, and play out a counterbalance. I can just simply not crack and hold up Counterspell. I can spin the top, not be able to play either of those, so Swords to Plowshares, or who knows what else. But each line of play is different based on what I expect my opponent to be. I knew if he was Infect that I had time. You know, he did not play a turn one Infect creature. I had Swords to Plowshares up, and I had the means to play through days. But if he was True Name Bug, I had to be ready to handle a turn three Jace.
turn one, turn two, Leovold was going to be manageable thanks to the swords, or potentially counterspell. Turn two, true name would be, I'd handle it eventually. But both decks I had to play around days, and against a true name I'd have to play around abrupt decay. And so based on what I expected to be, and perhaps most significantly, what would be the worst outcome if I was wrong, influences how I'm going to play. So I chose to take most defensive play, which was actually just spinning the top. I chose not to hold up counterspell for the potential whatever, and maybe get hit by a daze and be a get it. I chose not to play up the counterbalance for basically the same reason, because from that turn one noble, I knew that the number one thing I had to fear was the Jace. Now, I learned turn two that he was on infect. He played a wooden foothills and fetched a second chop, so he's on infect. But, it's those types of, you need to know immediately off that noble that it's one of two decks. And you need to know how you're going to play on those two decks. And most significantly, you have to know what is your worst case outcome here. It's okay if I make a play that isn't 100% against infect, because if he is infect, I'm not really in that much trouble anyways. I already have source supply of shares, and he doesn't have a turn two swinging infect creatures, so I must be doing fine. Worst case scenario is he's true name bug and has, as I've said, I think 3 times now, the Jace.
Can we go a little bit deeper on that? The fact that your opponent fetched out a tropical island on turn two as well tells us more about the context of their hand too and how you're playing the game at that point. So you've identified them as infect at this point. You know what about their hand at that point. You know that they probably have at least one infect creature, guessing a blighted agent, since he didn't play one on turn one. Or if he does have a Glistener Elf or another infect creature, that he probably has mild to moderate protection for the card, since he ran the Hierarch out first. What are you gleaning from this context?
Yeah, it means you're right. I'm going to assume that my infect opponent is going to keep my opener with an infect creature in his hand. It's possible to keep the pumps, cantrips, noble, but if that's the case, then I'm even under that much less of a threat of being caught blind, because if he kept open with no infect creatures, then being wrong about any of my estimations has less consequences. But you're right. It means he most likely didn't have the Glistener Elf, though since I was on the play, he might have been making a line of play to have a turn two Glistener with, say, Vines protection up. But it does most likely mean he has Blighted Agent. Honestly, that's all you can infer at that point, because he hasn't made any other plays. But what's important is you don't have to know everything about their hand. You just have to have a general idea of how to play around what they could have. And in fact, the sort of deck, it's not going to take long to know what they're playing, but also there's very little variance in what their hands could be. It's going to be pump spells, it's going to be infect creatures, and it's going to be cantrips to find those cards.
It's got to be a good feeling knowing you can fetch freely and not have to worry about Wastelands ruining your day. And I know that's a big concern for decks like True Name Bug and Leovold, that they could be up against an unknown deck that's playing Wasteland and just blow them out, which is why they have and play such a robust basic count.
A whopping 3.
But those... Oh, yeah. Hey, that's robust.
They don't only run a basic forest and island.
But those basic lands, combined with other cards, can act as those signposts as far as identifying what deck your opponents are on. So just the plains by itself on turn one from your opponent, not very descriptive. But if it's planes into Aether Vial or Mother of Runes, you can be 95% sure it's Death and Taxes. Planes into Sensei's Divining Top, for example, probably going to be a Miracles deck. Other examples, like we used earlier, Mountain into Goblin Guide from Burn. Well, you know they're going to burn your face off because of the Goblin Guide. But if instead it was a Mountain into a Monastery Swift Spear, you could be looking at Burn or Blue-Red Delver. Especially if they led with a fetch into the mountain.
I think if they led with a fetch into the mountain, then you can be much more confident of being burned. Blue Red Delver is not the sort of deck that would waste time protecting its basics. Protecting its lands from Wasteland. But you're right. That's the sort of line of play where you have to be aware that it's one or two decks. And once again, you know that both decks are very, very aggressive decks. So fortunately,
both decks require the same lines of play against them.
So let's use this as a thought experiment. Basic lands are really good signpost cards. What decks would lead on a turn one basic island, and what can we infer about the cards that might get played with the island to tell you what they're playing?
Well, the decks that play that have basic islands are True Name Bug, Blue Red Delver, Miracles, Storm, Show and Tell, Alurin.
Okay. So from that list of Alurin, True Name Bug, Miracles, Sneak and Show, Blue Red Delver, which of those, when you pair that with another card, which deck are you likely playing against? So for example here, I think that True Name Bug and Alurin and Shardless would be far less likely to play the turn one island and instead opt for a turn one death rite or one drop, because the strength of their hand is dictated by their one drops a lot of times.
True, it's unlikely they kept a hand where their turn one play was island something. But frankly, most all these decks on the list would keep a hand with turn one island ponder, and all of them could play turn one island ponder. Another way to look at it is that I think out of all the decks I listed, Show and Tell and Miracles are the only ones to play multiple islands.
I think Blue Red Dawn is three, but...
The point is, you know, it's more unlikely to be the bug decks because it's just that statistically unlikely that they would have had their basic island in their opener compared to a deck like Miracles. And also, if they don't make a play, that's a huge tell. That means it's basically, it's probably just Miracles or Show and Tell at that point, because every other deck would have to be somewhat aggressive with its turn one plays, and island would be its.
I think even Miracles and Show and Tell have some pairing cards, is what I would call them, you know, to help indicate one direction or another. Specifically, Show and Tell, they will run preordains in addition to Ponder and Brainstorm. And Show and Tell will often run out a turn one Lotus Petal just to get it under Daze that one turn so they can't be pinched on their critical turn, as opposed to Storm, who will save their Lotus Petals for Storm count and play through the Daze because it has more mana generation. And then you look at Miracles, which definitely, you know, plays Ponder just like all these other decks, but also has Sensei's Divining Top as a telltale sign that, hey, I'm on Miracles. I'm a filthy degenerate who has a superiority complex. So like we said, all that information is really contextual, and it comes down to knowing what the deck lists are, which I'll be the first to tell you, it takes a long time in Legacy. It took me a while to figure out what all the deck lists are, and not only that, but you want to stay abreast of the technology and make sure that you know what's popular now, what's being played, what's evolving, and it builds on this big catalog. But the more decks you acquaint yourself with, the more you look at, the more you play against, the stronger your play will be because you can identify these turn one decks. In this part of the show, we'll be analyzing some sample hands from the decks. Now, Peter, Topher, and Adam have not been informed about which decks I'm going to be discussing. I will be telling them what their opponent plays on turn one, assuming their opponent has won the die roll, and they will be in charge of figuring out what they're playing, what they're most likely playing, and we'll follow through and see how they did. Alrighty, you guys ready to ready for this game here?
I was born ready.
Alrighty. So, your opponent wins the die roll, and they say to you, I'll draw. What is happening right now?
They're playing Maelstrom Dredge, so congrats to them. We will if our deck has the means to beat Maelstrom Dredge game one, we will look for a hand that does it.
I will.
Whether that's Death Rite Shaman or comboing.
Alrighty. That turn one Death Rite Shaman mulligan. Yeah, you're totally right. Maelstrom Dredge. mulliganing into a turn one Death Rite Shaman. Mulliganing into a turn one Death Rite Shaman is so pivotal against them. Easy one, done with. All right, our first example here. Our opponent leads.
Second example.
First real example. Come on, Topher.
All right.
First real example. Your opponent leads with Swamp, and then they Thought Seize you.
All right. So my first guess is Reanimator. I should say at first what decks play Basic Swamp and Thought Seize, and that would be
Reanimator, and certain bug builds. Shardless, not true name bug, but there are some odd mid-range bug lists. Like, bug mid-range is like this broad umbrella you can throw out and broaden out, I guess you could say, and just catch a bunch of different decks with it. This is bug mid-range or Reanimator.
My thoughts on this deck is not only if they are a bug deck, they're not one of the more tempo bug builds with like Delver and soft counter magic. So I know that I'll be able to basically not worry about any, you know, any counter magic besides potential force of will.
You as the respondent is going to have to basically, what is worth noting here is you don't have to make a decision on what they're playing until after you see what they take with Thoughtseize. Shardless Bug is going to take being scared of different things than Reanimator will. If they take the Force of Will, you're pretty certainly not playing Bug. Bug isn't going to give a shit about Force of Will unless they're, I don't know, trying to jam something super impressive turn three, but even then they still probably wouldn't worry about Force of Will.
I think the scariest play on turn two, would be a Sylvan Library, right?
Potentially. I mean, they certainly... You're right. From a bug deck, yes, you're right. Because that's the... it's a two-mana play that can, they'll strip your answer for it and then gone for it.
So we've got Topher thinking it's Reanimator or some bug deck. Adam, what do you think?
Yeah, that would be my guess as well. Either that or some fringe strategy.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. It's either one of those.
The thing is, if it is bug mid-range, they are going to be a black heavier version. If they follow up turn two, Deathrite Shaman, whatever, then you know you got to fear Lilianas and Hymns. So there you go.
Yeah, like Topher mentioned, a big tell of this deck is also going to be what they do take with the Thoughtseize.
All right, their turn two I'm just going to tell you their turn two play. Their turn two play is Badlands Faithless Looting.
All right, so we're partially right. Well, we're half right. Black Red Reanimator.
All right.
So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys got this. And these are going to increase in difficulty as we go along. So, next one is turn one, Underground Sea, Preordain.
Ant.
Storm.
Ant. It's called Ant, Peter.
Ad nauseum.
Tess doesn't run Preordain, Peter.
As opposed to Tess or Grinding Station, right? Does Grinding Station run it?
Well, Grinding Station and Ant are basically the same thing, but...
Kind of.
I don't know if Grinding Station runs it.
What do you think, Adam?
Number 9 and 10.
My first thought is immediately Ant.
All right, so their turn two play is Fetchland, Brainstorm.
What's the fetch?
Polluted Delta.
It's still Ant, because that's... Exactly. Still the only deck that plays Underground Sea and Preordain.
Just confirming, it's still Ant. So that is Ad Nauseam Tensor. Next one. I think you guys will be able to get this one pretty easily. Your opponent leads with turn one Verdant Catacombs, cast a Mox Diamond, discard Barrenmoor, fetch Verdant Catacombs for Bayou, cast Life from the Loam.
Aggro Loam.
I guess it's worth saying that the reason, you know, it's not this and not Dark Lands is the Barrenmoor. For those of you who listen to this but don't know that.
Yeah, exactly. Barrenmoor is not played in lands. Bayou is sometimes played in lands, depending on the versions, but Barrenmoor is never played in lands. Unless you're that weird guy with that nonsense bug land list.
And so it would be worth saying that from the aggro loan player's perspective, it would be to his advantage to not discard a Barrenmoor if he has any other options.
Another good tell for this, they're basically telegraphing that while they are on aggro loan, that they do not have a Chalice of the Void.
Also true.
Yeah.
Which, when I see that play happen, I have a big old sigh of relief.
I mean, frankly, the telegraphing don't have any other play. I mean, any other play is more powerful than that. Though, admittedly, the only other two mana plays are Bobs and
Punishing Fires, Sylvan Library, Chains of
Epistaphanes. I don't think they run Chains mainboard.
Some
Chains
out of the
board. But yes, the lesson I get. They basically have a lot other better two mana plays than Loaming for a Baron Moor. So it means they're, I mean, it probably means their hand has three drops in it, but it doesn't mean they don't have any two drops.
All right, our next one. Your opponent leads with Island Ponder, followed by Lotus Petal.
Sneak and Show.
Well, it is most likely, basically, it's either Sneak and Show or a very bad ant player.
Do you think it's possible it's also Black Blue Reanimator?
Oh, you know, that's something to consider.
From that play, we can determine they're at least on combo.
Yeah, you know they're on combo. Sneak and Show and Reanimator are played against similarly. Yeah, I mean, the big thing here is that they played out the Lotus Petal. So you're right. It's either Show and Tell or Reanimator. Though, once again, it's worth noting that it would be to the combo player's incentive not to play out the Lotus Petal yet. Keep the mystery up. So if they're just playing it and not using it, then they're trying to play around effects like Thalia and Daze. Neither of those rule out Reanimator or Sneak and Show, so you're still basically wondering which one of those it is.
Yeah, they could definitely like see what you're on and then end step the Entomb.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, Reanimator would be the one most willing to use that Lotus Petal immediately. Mm-hmm. So if you somehow had a line of play that was good against Reanimator but not good against Sneak and Show or vice versa, it'd be to your incentive to do Reanimator.
Kind of like the difference between a turn one Death Rite or a turn one Delver Secret.
Yes.
Alrighty. Their turn two follow-up is rather telling, if you will, no pun intended, Ancient Tomb Pass.
Well, it means they're on Show and Tell, but it also means they either do not have a sneak attack or choosing not to play it out, or they are lacking either Fatty or Show and Tell. And in fact, if they don't cantrip either, that's very interesting. Their hand must not be that good at that point.
So if they don't cantrip, that is, what is their hand likely to have in it?
I would assume it has an Intuition or Cunning Wish, something that will let them combo off the next turn, because with a deck like Show and Tell, if you're not doing anything on the first three turns besides one Ponder, you should have Mulligan.
They could also be sitting on a Brainstorm, but if they have an Ancient Tomb and Lotus Petal, they would also be incentivized to main phase Brainstorm turn to hit a Show and Tell Fatty. Unfortunately, this does not mean that their hand is bad. They could still be very good.
It doesn't mean it's as fast as they would hope, though. Correct. It's missing one tool. And that was... yes.
All right.
Next one. Your opponent leads with Arid Mesa, pass turn.
So this could... My thoughts... I'm thinking this is Miracles. Arid Mesa is a pretty infrequently played fetch. It's generally a one or two of in Miracles. Percentages, it's more likely to be Miracles here.
No Imperial Taxes?
It could be Imperial Taxes, but...
I would agree.
I would identify it as Miracles.
Yeah, and that is what they're playing, as their turn two play is Island, Sensei's Divining Top, pass. Miracles it is.
They drew Sensei's Divining Top, is what you're saying?
Yeah, so what does that tell you about their hand composition?
that they drew Sensei's Divining Top. That's what that tells me.
So what does it tell you about the rest of their hand?
Oh, it could mean a lot of things. They have some measure of lands. They probably also have a cantrip. They wouldn't have kept a hand without top or cantrips. Well, they could have, but it wouldn't have been as good.
I would also say that I would assume that it would also be a Brainstorm rather than a Ponder, because you'd think that they would fetch Tundra
Ponder. I would assume...
Well, they would have gone turn with Island Ponder at that point.
I would assume that it's way more likely. I would assume that my opponent has a Brainstorm or a Swords to Plowshares to lead on Arid Mesa.
Yeah.
Because if they got Brainstorm, they can wait until the next turn, play the Island, and then perfect Brainstorm.
They wanted to keep their options open for the turn one Swords, so I didn't play the Island.
Perfect. All right, next one. Your opponent leads with Scalding Tarn into Underground Sea, Delver of Secrets.
Probably Grixis Delver.
It could be Grixis Delver. It could be Four Color Delver. It could be the Blue Heavy Bug Delver. It would not be Rug Delver, obviously. It would not be the Him Bug Delver. It would not. I guess it was the only two Bug Delvers that are ruled out.
Why would it not be Him Delver?
Because they wouldn't run the Scalding Tarn. Him Delver runs Bayous, so all their fetches need to be Bug fetches. Whereas it doesn't rule out Stifle Bug Delver because they don't run Bayous. They run Trops and Underground Seas, so they don't run Blue Fetches.
Topher honed in
Scalding Tarns.
Topher honed in on the most important part of that analysis right there, is that Scalding Tarn into Underground Sea.
Yeah, so I mean, percentage-wise, I'm going to just assume it's Grixis Delver. What's fortunate is that all of these Delver decks that it could be, the Stifle Bug, Four Color, and Grixis. The Stifle Bug and Grixis are both reasonably low to the ground. Four Color can be a little bit more mid-rangey.
I think the most important factor here is that just from here, even though you're not sure whether it's Four Color or Grixis Delver yet, you are able to identify what their threat package is immediately because the overlap is very high between those two decks.
And what's also important is you got to figure out what is your most likely chance to get blown out here. And it's basically Stifle. They have not go Verdant Catacombs. So you know they're not a Himbug, which means they can still be running Stifle. So you got to choose between fetch, you know, maybe you want to hold up that fetch to take advantage of Brainstorm. But honestly, it's probably more important just to have the land in the first place. So I would crack your fetch now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, next also, turn, maybe then you'll see it.
I would also consider, if possible, if your hand allows, you want to be looking for a basic land. Because
I 100% agree.
With Delver comes Wasteland.
Yeah, you know they're 100% playing at least three copies of Wasteland, and you're not 100% about the Stifle. So if you have the basic, I would say go for it. And if you don't, then I would actually not fetch.
Ooh.
If I didn't have any other plays, because they're way more likely, in my opinion, to have a Wasteland than a Stifle.
Yes, but the Waste... I mean, unless your hand is held together by turn two plays, by two mana plays,
mm-hmm.
that Wasteland is going to hit you whenever you crack that fetch.
Mm-hmm.
First time you use it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you crack the fetch early, that Stifle is... I mean, make them have it sort of deal.
Yeah.
You can play around the Stifle. You can't really play around this Wasteland. If you don't have basic effects, you're not playing around it. So unless you have such a hugely critical 2-mana turn 2 play that isn't scared of days, then that makes you want to protect your fetch, your land from a Wasteland, from a turn 2 Wasteland, mm-hmm. then I'm still just cracking that fetch.
No, that definitely makes sense to me.
And frankly, most decks do have turn 1 plays, so yeah.
I got one more for you, a little bit more difficult, but all in good fun. Your opponent leads on turn one, Bayou, Sensei's Divining Time.
Nykvit. Nykvit or Ant. So I guess the worst thing to note is what decks run top. That's more narrow than what decks run Bayou. And the decks that run top are Miracles, Storm Variants, but mainly Ant. Frankly, I think it's only Ant. I don't think Tess runs it. Doomsday. That's good. I forgot about Doomsday. Nykvit. Painter decks run it. I think that's it.
And yeah. A large percentage of those don't run Bayou.
Yeah. The only ones those run Bayou are Ant as their one of their greens lands and Nykvit. It's really unlikely that Ant would have kept a hand that was held together that their only land was Bayou. Maybe the Ant made it the top made it keepable for them. I think it's much more likely that it's Nykvit. Though Nykvit is obviously I wouldn't say much more likely. I mean it's like a low percentage opener from Ant or a more reasonable opener from a much lower percentage deck. Nykvit is a very slow deck, so you don't really have to play around a Nykvit. You can just wait to see if it's Nykvit. So if you're looking to play, you know, what to play around, it's just better to play around Ant at this point. Just because the penalty of being wrong is much more severe if it's Ant.
Yeah, and you know, they could be trying to protect their... Maybe they have a hand that's by you, you know, Volcanic Island, and Ant only runs one Volcanic Island, so
yeah,
they want to protect their red source from being wastelanded.
Yeah, that's true.
All right.
That also being play, they determine that the top will be their opener play, so they don't want the blue source getting wastelanded before they can cantrip turn two.
Exactly.
Who knows?
All right, their turn two play is Verdant Catacombs, fetch Underground Sea, cast Baleful Strix.
That's Nykvit. That is, yeah, both Nykvit.
Nykvit, anyone else? Anything else it could be?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything else.
Okay.
I'm sure there's
Bug
Brew.
The deck, actually, I think Nykvit is a fine assessment. The deck that I'm looking at is the most recent version of Bug Allurin.
Top?
They're running top?
They're running top as a one of. to pair up with their Glintness Crane.
Foolishness is this.
Glintness Crane, man. That card's a boss.
Trying more artifacts. I'm running Trinket Mage soon.
I mean, that gives me a raging semi. Why not Treasure Mage so they can go get that Parasitic Strix?
Trophy Mage.
Go get Parasitic Strix.
Oh, man. That what value they can get Parasitic Strix or the Trinisphere that completely shuts down their combo.
Just rando Trinisphere. Want to mess up my mana, do you? Well, two can play at that game.
I can mess up my own mana.
All right, well, it sounds to me like you guys, unsurprisingly, are able to easily identify all of these decks. But there is a science to it, and it's not always so easy and requires a lot of format knowledge. And I encourage you, if you have any challenging deck openers or ones that you're unsure about, shoot us an email at sstmtgcast@gmail.com. We will happily go over them on the air next week, and we will help you if you're having trouble identifying the right deck. We'll be back in just a minute with our super secret tech of the week. This week's super secret tech of the week is a rehash of a legacy classic dating back to pre-2005, a deck called the Mighty Quinn. The Mighty Quinn is a mono-white control deck, or prison, as we like to call it, named after a Bob Dylan song in 1967. Basically, the deck is mono-white prison, and it seeks to gain card advantage by setting up Scrying Sheets and Sensei's Divining Top, using the Scrying Sheets with their various snow-covered planes to just draw free lands every turn. In addition to making land drops every turn thanks to Scrying Sheets and Sensei's Divining Top, the deck also runs some number of Eternal Dragons, as well as Prison and Lock pieces to hold down the fort. Now, these aren't your normal Prison or Lock pieces in the form of Chalice of the Void, Trinisphere, traditionally. These are Isochron Scepter Lock pieces, perhaps, using Silence or Abeyance or Aurum's Chant to lock your opponent out of spells, fortified by Moat, Enlightened Tutor package, little bit of Wrath effects, and in some variants, a Painter Servant Grindstone finish. Old lists sometimes run Sacred Mesa as a way to get up over the top and kill your opponent. So how much of this did you experience over the weekend, Peter? Are you still having, like, haunted dreams? Are your nightmares you being cooked alive, surrounded in an igloo by many little Eskimo men stabbing you with Isochron Scepters?
Well, this guy wasn't on the Isochron. He was on the Enlightened Tutor package. And game one, I'm trying to do my lands things, and he's playing these basic that I can't do anything about. Around turn three, my opponent played Rest in Peace, followed thereafter by Ensnaring Bridge and Leyline of Sanctity, at which point I conceded the game as I had no way to win that game in the main board. Sideboard, I brought in some Crows and Grips and then learned his actual win con was Helm of Obedience and Rest in Peace combo.
That's surprisingly clean for a prison deck that's trying to make you miserable.
Yeah, I can successfully tell you I've never played it before.
And you hope you don't play it again, I'm sure.
I would certainly hope to never play it again. Not on lands, anyway.
I know I've played a few different variants of this deck throughout my time with Legacy. Probably 3 or 4 years ago, I played against Mono White Prison List running the good old Land Tax Scroll Rack engine. And probably about a month ago on Magic Online, I played against yet another different variant that played main deck Leyline of Sanctities. At the time, I was on Storm, so I, you know, turn zero Leyline to me. I couldn't Tendrils them, so I made turn one. I thought, you know, thought I was in great shape. Made 14 Goblins, and his first land drop was Tabernacle. So, needless to say, that was not a lot of fun. Surprisingly, large amount you can do with the mono white prison archetype, whether it be Orm's Chant or Silence or the Scrying Sheets engine.
Oh, he had Scrying Sheets too.
So, long story short, if you are looking to get into Legacy on the cheap and happen to have some Ensnaring Bridges from Modern and really like making people sad with Rest in Peace and are perfectly willing to die to Abrupt Decays and Force of Wills, then the Mighty Quinn is a deck for you. All right, cool.
And he even knew it was like a budget deck.
It's funny because it gives you access to cards like Main Deck Rest in Peace, which like sometimes are just like so good.
Lastly, we'd like to wrap up with an audience trivia question. Our question last week was, what Alliance's card was nicknamed Good Buddy during playtesting? The answer is Lord of Tressorhorn, who is named as such because his power and toughness is, of course, 10-4. Apparently, during playtesting, this card was a 9-4, but was bumped up to 10-4 just so the moniker could be internally used. Turns out it stuck and wasn't too powerful. Congratulations to Dominic M., who is this week's trivia winner. We will be emailing you shortly to get your address so we can send you your fancy pants Golgari Grave Trolls. Now, on to this week's trivia question. What change to templating with the Exodus set symbol do that had never been done before? If you know the correct answer to this week's trivia question, shoot us a line at sstmtgcast@gmail.com. That's sstmtgcast@gmail.com. We will randomly select a winner from all of this week's correct answers to receive a draft set of Aether Revolt and Kaladesh. You can find the show on Twitter at SuperSecretMTG. You can also find me on MTGO at OneWithNothing, Adam on MTGO at ABombDiggity, Topher on MTGO at MZFrost, and Peter on MTGO at Brains478. Any questions, comments, concerns, tips, tricks, or the trivia answer for today's cast can be emailed to the same email address I mentioned earlier, which is sstmtgcast@gmail.com. On behalf of myself, Adam, Topher, and Peter, thank you very much for listening. We will catch you next week.